Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
This podcast is brought to you by the new term at FXPhD.com. This term is particularly focused on the high end, with more 300-level courses than ever before. If it's been a while since you last looked at FXPhD, you might want to check it out again. Head over to FXPhD.com, where we like to think we help you take your career to the next level.
Hi, and welcome to this FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery, and guess what feature film we're covering this week, the week of October 7th. Joined with a special intro by my friend Mike. How's it going, my friend?
Good, good. Yes, I can answer that question, John. Gravity.
Gravity. Wow.
Yes.
What an amazing film. That was my three-word tweet, four-character tweet with the exclamation point that I made after seeing that film. What an amazing piece of work that film is. Truly groundbreaking, truly compelling, and just fantastic visual effects work and storytelling.
It's funny, isn't it? Because I was talking to someone afterwards about the trailer, and I was trying to explain to them, look, you just can't appreciate the film from the trailer, because apart from anything else, one of the things that makes the film so startling are these really long, very meaningful shots and her sense of isolation. You can't get that from a trailer because by definition, they're cutting up shots for the trailer. So.
Yeah, really stunning. That first sequence, and even if it just felt like a very long sequence in the beginning right off the bat, it really set the mood for the full film. I found myself going, wow, this is just crazy. So we're really excited and happy to be able to bring a podcast so quickly to you guys about this film. We're getting a little bit of a jump thanks to folks at the studio to let us get out the word and get out some details behind the scene. So,
yeah, Mike, I think this film is really technically interesting, and I'm sure the community is desperate to sort of have a bit more of an insight into how the team at Framestore did it, because it's a really spectacular piece of work in addition to the storytelling, right? I mean, it's a good story, but it's... I should say also, just for a warning, for some of you in some countries, this film has not been released, and so there is, of course, a discussion of the film, and it would give away plot points. So if you are in a country that has opened in the US and other places, but if you're in a country that hasn't opened yet, just a spoiler alert.
Yeah, really, very much so. Well, hey, before we get to the podcast, though, just a really quick mention about our new term over at FXPhD that we started last week. Don't want to take a lot of time talking about it. You guys can head over to FXPhD and check it out. We just released the orientation video, which gives you an overview of the courses. But one thing I think of particular interest to those of you listening is we really bumped up the level of advanced courses this term, Mike, didn't we?
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the things that PhD we got known for, which is doing very high-end courses. And look, it's not just this term. I think we had the first Arnold course ever in the world kind of thing, and a whole lot of other sort of things that have come along. But lately, we thought, in response to the request that people made, we would increase the number of the high-level courses. In other words, as John said, the 300-level courses, the hardest courses we do. So, for example, we have a new course at 100 level, which is something that somebody might look at if they were coming over from After Effects. But we have a 300 level, which is really a serious course on Nuke, and you want to be already up to speed with a lot of Nuke before you tackle that.
Yeah, so head on over to FXPhD to check that out. There's an orientation video on the homepage. Click the courses button for the entire rundown courses. And while we have a dozen new courses, but man, we have over 100 repeats as well. So be sure to check out the entire list there over at FXPhD.com. But Mike, getting back to this podcast, you had the opportunity to chat with Timothy Weber who served as VFX supervisor on this.
Yeah, and remember, John, we sat down with him actually in end of 2006 at in London at the boardroom of what was then Framestore CFC, right?
Another film with very long effect shots in it.
Well, that's because of the same director. Children of Men, yeah. Yeah, no, what a great film that was. I love Children of Men. I thought it was a terrific film. Anyway, yes, so we've met Tim, and of course it was a joy to sit down and talk to him again for this podcast. This is quite a long podcast because I think the subject matter really warrants it, and also I think the guys just did a spectacularly good job. So, this is going to be coupled with, of course, a written story over at fxguide.com. So if you're just listening to the podcast and you want to see some of the imagery, including we talk about this thing called the light box, and you really need to see some pictures of that before you can get a handle on how it is, and also stuff on the Bot and Dolly, which is this enormous rig that sat in front of it. And again, we have stuff illustrating that, explaining that, and running through that, in addition, of course, to the main body of that, which is, of course, on Framestore's work.
Yeah, and we actually saw that dolly in action Jeff and I did here in L.A., what Cinegear, I think it is, as we saw that. And boy, really, what a crazy fast movement with that system. Really amazing when you're used to other rigs. When you see this rig for the first time, it's pretty impressive.
It's funny, I looked up the specs on it. It can move at 4 meters per second. It can fly around with, you know, 7 degrees of axis and stuff. But its tolerance on stopping is 0.8 of a millimeter. That's pretty good.
And it seems a bit less dangerous, potentially, than the Milo, if I'm getting hit by.
I'm not aware of the Milo being not safe, but certainly this rig would want to be safe because, as I think the director said at Comic-Con, if you've got this rig hurtling at an actress's head, which it, of course, needs to do for some shots, you really want it to stop reliably, and of course it did. And Sandra Bullock, obviously focus on the visual effects, but man, I think Sandra Bullock really put in a great performance in this film. I thought she was really, really good.
She really did, and what an amazing performance. And I think, Mike, especially after hearing also what she has to go through in filming and being in the suit and effectively putting up with that rig and what she had to do to have that performance shine through is doubly impressive in my book.
But I want to also give a shout out to the Framestore tech team. Now, I'm not talking about the animators and the effects sims guys because they're all awesome, right? But just behind the scenes, the IT department of Framestore, as you'll hear in this podcast in a minute, put it this way, listen out for when you would have had to start a render I'll leave this with you. Just think about this question because it's answered in the podcast. When would you have had to start a render on a single core machine to have completed a render that appeared in Gravity? So in other words, if I started the render on Thursday and it was finished on Friday using the massive render farm that Framestore has, well and good. But if I'd started on a single machine, what day, what week, what year would it have had to have been started so that it would have finished, any time this year?
And if you actually nail that, let us know. And I know that's leaving it up to the honor system, but I'd love to hear from you if you actually nail that, the answer to that question, because there's no way
wrong.
I was way off base on that one as well. So anyway, some really amazing stuff as part of this podcast. So why don't we go ahead and cross to that interview now. Again, it's Mike chatting with Tim Weber, the VFX supervisor.
So firstly, congratulations on the film. What a remarkable achievement.
Thank you.
I've got to say that in my line of work, we hear a lot about what's kind of going on kind of off the record or as it were, you know, just in the grapevine. I started hearing about this film almost earlier than any film I can remember in recent times. Not that I heard anything specific about it because, of course, it's confidential. Just literally the word was out that there was really interesting things going on in London with Gravity and that it was going to be, you know, game-changing and keep an eye out for it. And I wasn't disappointed when I saw it. You must have been quite a mountain to climb.
Right from the word go, I think we realised it was going to be very tricky, and then very quickly as we started to work on it, we realised that it was going to be even harder than we'd initially thought. I think, it was a mountain to climb, and I think it was pretty obvious from early on that it was going to be different to any other films, and that was something we were aware of as we were working on it. It was clear because whenever a new person came to join the team in any department, not just in visual effects, but it would kind of take 2 weeks before they could understand the process and the way the film worked, because it was so different to any sort of previous method of making a film, really, that it kind of took that long for people just to be able to understand what we were talking about, and start to sort of get involved. Because, there was a lot of different processes involved, really.
It must have been quite funny if someone was to come and visit you on set in an official capacity, because instead of lots of grip trucks and gaffers and crew and craft services and tons of people all standing around with thousands of sets, you've got like one box, one track and a lot of computers.
Yes, I mean it was a very different image on set, walking onto the set, particularly the box you're talking about, the light box is a very strange contraption. We had some other strange contraptions as well, not much was in any way traditional. There were one or two little bits that, you know, looked like a normal movie making experience, but very little really. And yes, you know, people would walk on, and I think in a way that was why, as you were saying earlier, you know, sort of people were talking about it a bit and not really, you know, sort of understanding it kind of thing, not being quite sure what it was, but it kind of, you know, there was something strange about this film, Gravity. It is a bit different because, you know, some people would walk, you know, visit on set, etc. Nothing like a normal movie, really.
So clearly the industry, as represented by FX Guide, is terribly interested to understand as much as we can kind of the approaches and the work that you've done, because it really is groundbreaking. So obviously there were some traditional aspects to it. There were some traditional sets that were, you know, inside of the Chinese craft and stuff, and obviously when she gets back to Earth. But if I could just discuss the crucial new approach to how you solved the fundamental issue of these very, very long shots of zero G, I think everyone would just benefit so much from getting some of your insight as to how you tackled them.
Sure. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, in your question, you say the very long shots of zero G, and that is a critical point to what made it the challenge. It wasn't just having to simulate zero G, which is tricky, but having to do it in the very long shots. So it was doing long shots is a challenge, doing zero G is a challenge, but when you add them together, well, they don't add together, they multiply by each other and make it incredibly complicated, because not just because of the pure length of the shot, but in order to make those long shots, in order to, you know, make the film interesting with long shots, you're telling the story with the camera all the time. And so it's changing from a big wide beauty shot of the environment to a, you know, two shot intense dialogue shot to a single, to an action shot, to, you know, another wide shot, to, you know, all of everything within the one shot. So you sort of have to come up with a solution that can create a single shot that works across all the different types. You know, I mean, you know, when people have done zero G before on things like Apollo 13, which, you know, is one of the very few films that has done it very, very well before, I think. But, you know, they used the vomit comet, which you can just about get away with a 5-second shot for, maybe a little bit longer. And then they'd just, you know, you'd cut to a close up and they'd just be standing on an apple box wobbling around, and it would work for a close up and, you know, for 10 seconds, and then they'd do something else for another bit. So,
yeah, I mean, even in the American sitcom Big Bang Theory, they had, you know, sort of a comedian, an actor, you know, sort of playing zero G for like a couple of shots, and they were just on a seesaw, and with some good acting and some good puppeteering, I guess, you know, you can sell a shot. But you and I sat down at the end of 2006 to discuss Children of Men, and I dropped by Framestore in London. The birth sequence in that was a long shot, and I want to start that as a point of reference, because I think it's terribly important to just pick up on that point you just made, that this isn't long shots for long shots' sake, nor is it gratuitously flying around like we've seen in computer graphics just because a camera can fly around. I mean, this is the hallmark of the director's skill in storytelling, that he can take a scene like that birth sequence, which also had CGI in it, make it an incredibly emotionally powerful scene, but just not through the use of cuts and reframing that a traditional edit process would give you.
Absolutely. And there's something enveloping about the single continuous, you know, takes that is you feel like you are there, because you're not doing impossible moves. You know, when a camera cuts, it's like you as a viewer have moved from one position to another position.
Yeah.
And you're aware that all sorts of things can be cheated and changed as that happens, you know. Whereas if you, in order to get from the two shot round to a single looking the other way, you have to, you know, as an audience member or as the camera, you have to make that transition, then you feel like you're a presence within the movie, I think. You know, that's how I see it, is it makes you feel like you're there. So So I think that is one of the reasons it is such an experience, this movie, is because of that. And I think, you know, Alfonso's talent is well, one of his many talents is to be able to make that happen, but in a way that still, you know, that the shots aren't ever boring. You never go through a point that isn't the right thing for the, you know, for the storytelling, or isn't the right, you know, isn't an interesting piece of camera, because it's all choreographed so carefully. And that was the first part of the process, was an awful lot of previs, you know, a long time spent on previs, just choreographing what was needed out of those shots, because making it all work, making it all tie together when there's so much going on in it, is, you know, takes a lot of work, a lot of previs.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about editing, the great thing about editing is it lets you jump time. And that's the other problem that I mean, the word choreography, it seems to have a particular relevance here, because, you know, you need a character to move from a point on screen to another point on screen, and you can't just put a cut in to get them there. You have to, as it were, if it was a badly done shot, and I'm not saying it was, you'd have to suffer the time it took them to get from A to B before we could sort of feel like we were picking it up again. So you had to have none of those dead spots. You had to have them relevant between A and B, because we weren't going to cut away to let them just suddenly be at position B.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think that's exactly, you know, the right phrase. You know, it's the trying not to suffer the time it takes to get either them from A to B, or the camera from A to B, or, you know, whatever it is that you have to do. That's one of the things that made the choreography a challenge, was to make sure that happened. And one of the things that helped in that challenge, but also made it more technically difficult, was that because you're in zero gravity, the camera can literally move anywhere. You know, it's not, when you're filming a normal movie, even if you're doing crane moves that go up and down a bit, you're kind of constrained with the camera to the ground plane, and the characters are very much constrained to the ground plane. Whereas in space, there is no up, there's no down, you know, so the camera goes above and below and turns upside down, and one character will be upside down to another character. And, you know, that gives you a certain amount of freedom to make it more interesting, although it also adds quite a degree of technical challenge into then making that happen on your screen.
So, Tim, could you talk about the role of the cinematographer? Because clearly, normally, you would use, I guess, previs as a point of departure. Like, we understand we've got the beats now, we understand how it's kind of going to work, but we'll take advantage of the actors in the space on the day. If I see something, you know, I'll go for it. And that's not a role that this film allowed in those sequences. So was the DOP involved in that previs then?
Yes. So we did the previs, spent quite a long time working on the previs. And then Chivo, the DOP, became involved, and we did what was called a pre-light, you know, what we called a pre-light. So, you know, he was involved from those stages, and it became the blurring of the line between visual effects and cinematography. You know, there was a great crossover, and there was no firm line. And, you know, he got much more involved in visual effects than cinematographers ever get, and I got much more involved in the cinematography than visual effects supervisors ever get, because in a movie like this, there is no definition, you know, there is no clarity between those two. So he was involved fairly early on. We would do, you know, he came over and we would do sessions pre-lighting it, and then for a few weeks. And then, you know, he was always on the other end of a line, even when he was on other shows and things. And then obviously on the shoot as well. But by then, as you're sort of saying, that an awful lot of the work was done by the time we were on the shoot. An awful lot of it had to be pre-designed, pre-worked out. You know, we were very lucky that Chivo was the cinematographer, you know, not just because he is a brilliant cinematographer, a very, very brilliant cinematographer, but he was also very willing and able to get his head around working through a different methodology to, you know, the one he normally works in, you know, lighting in the computer. I mean, we went to a lot of trouble to make it as like real-world lighting as possible, not, you know, well, initially because wanted it to feel as real as possible. And, you know, so using a physically based renderer was very important to me. And that was one of the big decisions I made on the show. And I think one of my best decisions, because it was very risky at the time we made it. But I really think it, you know, it made a big difference. So, it helped to make the light behave in a way, you know, that the main reason for it was to make it look beautiful and realistic. But it also, I think, helped for Chivo that the light was behaving in a way that he was used to. And we designed our lighting rigs within the computer to be very similar to traditional lighting rigs with bounces and blockers and things like that. I mean, the slight difference being we could make a white bounce card that was, you know, a kilometer by a kilometer if you wanted to bounce a light onto the ISS kind of thing. Because, you know, in space you might have to do that, and you're not constrained by the real world physics, you know, the physicality of it.
So I know this doesn't break into pre-production production and post. So if I use those terms, I apologize, but there's no other way to kind of describe the phases. But if we can stay in that pre-phrase for a second, I was wondering in terms of lensing how you approached it, because it seems to me that you could be free to use zoom lenses or to use primes that normally would be dictated to by whatever the cinematographer is going to have on set to be consistent, but you were kind of dictating it a little bit the other way. Did you have any notion of staying with like a prime lens, or did the lens just dynamically change whatever needed to be done to pull off the move?
On the whole, we're staying to prime lenses, and on the whole, there's sort of, you know, a large percentage of the movie is just on two or three lenses. You know, that is just the style that Alfonso likes, and it's the type of lens that works with the shots, you know, the long shots and the type of shots that we were doing in this movie. So on the whole, prime lenses. There are times when we slowly creep from one lens to another very occasionally, you know, it's sort of cheating really, you know, so essentially it still feels pretty much like it's on a prime lens. But there's a little bit of gradual creep, you know, changes just to help with certain transitions at some point.
Tim, there really is no sense of cheating because, I mean, it's all filmmaking, right? Like, you know, you're defining the rules. Like there is no, I don't think, I just wouldn't use the word cheating. I just think it's whatever.
No, that's true. Cheating is as you're right, not really the right phrase, but
You just produced a valid image that did what the director wanted emotionally with what they had. I was just curious how you pulled it off. and to that end, if you've got that previs worked out with presumably a notional lens, I am assuming that you would have had to do like a second abstraction from that. Like, okay, well, that's what the shot looks like. Now I have to almost work out a previs of how I would shoot that because, for example, you might want to scale somebody in post because there's no point building, you know, 100 meters of track when you could just build, you know, 10 and then scale them by 10% or 100%, whatever. So, you know what I'm saying? So was there another level of a technical kind of pass after that?
Yeah, there was. So we would do the previs and then we would do the pre-light. And then we would take the information from those two and do what we call the tech viz, which was exactly that. And it would be working out, abstracting it and changing the shot from, you know, what you see on the screen to what you would see in the studio, which would often look totally different. You know, generally the camera would be moving instead of the person or, you know, instead of a mixture of both. And therefore the camera move would be completely different to what you think it might be. But it was a bit of moving the actor as well. But we generally avoided tipping the actors more than 45 degrees in any direction, because as soon as you do, you start to see the strain on them. So, we wanted to keep them looking as if there was no strain on their face, because that's what you get in zero gravity. And if you tip them upside down, all the blood rushes to your head and you see the strain in the muscles on your neck, et cetera, et cetera. So we were minimizing how much they were being moved around and trying to achieve all the movement by moving the camera and the lights and everything around them, or, you know, et cetera. So yeah, there was quite a big process in abstracting that and working out what we needed to do. And the initial stage was the methodology stage where, you know, we'd worked out a few possible techniques of being able to shoot this, and we would try and work out which one would work best for each particular moment in the film. And then once we'd decided which one, we'd then sort of go through the technical details of doing a full tech viz and you know, showing on screen what would have to be happening on set in order to get it, and then outputting all the information for the various computer-controlled systems to achieve that on the set.
So let me ask a dumb question, and it's obviously dumb because you didn't do it. You've got a George Clooney character where obviously their suit and their environment and the space station behind them and the planet behind them and everything else is fully digital. It's just animation. Did you not sort of say, well, why don't we just go the rest of the way and do a kind of a light stage Benjamin Button Tron and just do a digital George Clooney face and then save yourself the trouble?
Well, we considered it and used it for some shots. We used light stage, to get some scans of George and Sandra, and for a few shots, they are CG faces, but pretty few, and less than we had originally intended, because the other techniques that we developed worked so well, and it's actually easier to use a real face if you can. And we found ways to get them to work. And, doing a CG face that is 100% believable and just you completely buy into and doesn't fall into the uncanny valley is still no easy achievement, and to do it for a whole movie would be a real challenge and wasn't the flavour that this movie needs, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So if I was wondering if we could just pick a shot and you could maybe talk us through it, because I assume now you've done the technical previews, you've done the actual previews, both the director and the DOP are happy and you're happy with what you're getting. Could you just walk me through? I mean, I don't know if I could pick something, but maybe we could discuss her inside the space station, because it seems a lot more taxing than just a face behind a mask, behind a reflection floating off. I mean, how did you physically solve that on the soundstage? What would you shoot for a shot like when she was floating through the space station?
Yeah, so you're right. Those were more challenging than the outside ones, as a rule. I mean, there's all sorts of different challenges in individual moments on both sides, but sure. As a rule, those sequences were more challenging because more of it is real Sandra. It's a lot easier just to shoot something the size of a face that's got the right lighting and the right movement on it than the whole body that has the right lighting and the right movement on it. So yes, those were definitely more challenging. So I think the first thing just to say is when we did the previs, it had to be quite a few levels beyond what you would normally need to do for previs. You know, when you normally do previs, you're just generally working out roughly what happens in the shot. And each shot and how they're going to cut together. So everyone has a general idea of what the action's going to be. Whereas in this, not all the time, it depended on exactly what was going on in the shot, but sometimes we would have to work it out. We would have to animate right down to kind of what the fingers were doing, because when you're floating around in zero gravity, if you push with one finger, you start to move. And over the length of a long shot, that can make you end up in a completely different place in the scene to where you would have if you hadn't pushed with that one finger, if you see what I mean. So the knock-on effect of very, very small bits of action could be huge because of the zero gravity and the length of the shot. So we would have to animate to a very high degree over certain points to make sure that the flow of the shot made sense, because if we got the bumping around at the beginning of the shot wrong, it would look and we needed to change it later when we were watching it properly and go, oh, that doesn't work quite right, she needs to do something slightly different, it would have a massive knock-on effect on the whole of the rest of the shot. It just wouldn't make sense. So we would previs in some places to high level, then pre-light, as we said, and do the tech viz. We then, as I said, there was a few different methodologies for different parts. that would sometimes have to be joined together. You know, different bits of a shot would have to use different techniques. But essentially, the sort of most common technique would be then to have Sandra in some sort of a rig that we then move the camera and the lights around to backward engineer to what would be happening on the shot. So, you know, if she was flying down the ISS and the camera was kind of static, you would actually fly the camera past her and fly all the lights past her. And we used a number of different techniques to fly the lights. Initially, we were looking at putting lights on robots, but we did use that for a couple of shots, but on the whole, the size that the lights needed to be to get the correct softness of light around her and the complexity of the moves they went through made that pretty much impossible for most shots. So, you know, for instance, when they're outside, if you have a light that's 4 feet away from their head that is giving the correct size of softness that the earth bounce gives, it needed to be 15 feet across. And so having a light that's 15 feet across, moving around 4 feet away from the actor's head, it just gets in the way of everything. So, you know, so that was one technique, but didn't work very often. Sometimes it could be done simply with a human being just moving lights around. But on the whole, the technique we used that we found the most useful is the light box, which was a cube most of the time when we were shooting the heads, but it could change shape. We could make it a slightly taller, longer box to get these whole body shots, or tighten it in so it was closer if she was, or George was, close to something that needed light bouncing close to them. So it was this box that could change shape that was a bunch of LED panels that's essentially like an inward-facing screens of a giant, giant television screen. It, you know, it's based on the technology that they use to put the massive television screens behind rock concerts or at sports grounds or whatever. Right. And so we built this box of inward-facing LEDs. There was, I think, when it was in its normal configuration, there was essentially... So, yeah, these panels, each pixel is basically made out of an LED that we could control. There was essentially 1,800,000 individual lights that we could individually control, so that rather than moving a physical light, we could just, fade each individual light up and down or put different colours on different lights. And that would be how we would move a light around, not by moving anything physically, but moving the image on the screens, essentially. So from our pre-light, we would work out the lighting environment that they would be in and put that onto the inside of this box and move it around. And that gave us two things. It didn't just give us the correct lighting on them, but it also gave then the actor a sense of what was going on around them. You know, if Sandra is flying down the ISS... she could actually see, it wasn't a very clear picture, but she could see the gist of the ISS moving around her, and it helped to give them a sense of what was happening around them, and eye lines to certain objects. You know, we could, they could actually see, the handle they were grabbing. Quite often we would put a little red dot on it to make it easier to see, but... they could see the objects around them on the screens around them. So that helped.
Was there any kind of diffusion over those? Were you worried about a sort of pixelation? Because obviously when you get close to a big jumbotron, you do get quite distinctive pixel blocks. Or was it that tight that you didn't need to sort of diffuse it to sort of blend it?
There was fairly big pixel blocks, and we had to put diffusion on at certain points. A lot of the time it didn't particularly matter. Because the light just sort of blended and it was fine, but there were certain points definitely where we had to put diffusion on. And we also had to do a lot of work to, those LED panels, they have strange behavior. They have strange spectrums of light. They change color quite dramatically depending on what angle, and it's different on the vertical angle change to the horizontal angle change. It would be different. So we had to compensate for all of that. And, you know, there was a, it was quite a challenge to get it right. And particularly a challenge to set up the system that controlled it, that could give us all this movement of lights in the first place. But also it had to be flexible because, you know, despite pre-lighting it and pre-planning the lighting for the environment, you know, when you put Sandra or George in there, you know, you would want, Chivo would want to tweak the lighting a bit and, you know, to, as you would on set, to tweak it to suit them and to look exactly right at the time. So it had to be flexible so that he could do that. And it also had to be flexible because although these moves were all pre-planned and pre-programmed, you know, when you are involving an actor, you need to be able to respond to what they want out of the shot and you know, the speed and the timing of their performance. And if they want to change the performance slightly at one point, we would need to be able to do that. So as well as pre-programming it to a massive degree, we had to sort of build in flexibility. And there were certain points where there was no flexibility, and we would have to say to George and Sandra, particularly to Sandra in some of the bits like the interior that you're talking about, you know, right at the end of this point, we need you to put your hand exactly there and it needs to be at exactly this point. And she was brilliant, not only at accepting the fact that she was having to do that whilst giving her performance, but incredibly brilliant at putting her, you know, hitting marks with her hands in 3D space at the right time and being able to do it every time.
So, Tim, how did you extract her from that plate photography? Like, because you wouldn't have a green screen, you don't have any, she's in an environment.
Absolutely, yeah. We barely used, I think there was two bits of green screen in the whole movie for, you know, just two little moments. So there's barely any green screen. She was basically rotoscoped out of the environment. And we had to do certain things with the back, whatever was behind her, to make sure that that would work cleanly. But essentially, she was rotoscoped out. There was no way we could use green screen because you would get the green back. But, you know, because of the camera moves and everything moving around her and everywhere, you would get green spill all over her and you just wouldn't get the lighting you needed at all. So
yeah, I mean, the whole point of it was that you would have the correct light. A green screen 6 feet away from her would have been the exact opposite of what you wanted. And how much of her kind of, well, body really, was needed, because if she wasn't on a wire rig, so, and you said she wasn't hanging, so she must have at some point have been blended to a digital double.
Yes, she was. And as I said, there were different techniques. There were ones where she was hanging. We developed a new wire rig that was called a 12 wire rig, which I can explain in a minute. But yes, you're right. You know, sometimes she would be in a rig. We had one called the bicycle seat rig because she was essentially sitting on a bicycle seat. But one of her legs, you know, because that's quite precarious and she had to be a few feet up in the air to do this, one of her legs was heavily strapped in. So for all of that section, we would have to replace her leg. There are times when we replaced the whole sort of lower half of her body or, you know, bits and pieces with CG, you know, to do it. Yeah, because of that. But then also we did use, you know, for some sections, we used this thing called the 12-wire rig where essentially, we were puppeteering Sandra. We had she was attached by four different points, and each point had three wires going to it. So it's essentially a case of sort of triangulating that point of her attachment, meaning we could control the position of that point in 3D space exactly without any swinging or swaying. So we could literally puppeteer her, and we had a crew of puppeteers who had worked on War Horse, which was sort of kind of where we found them, which was a very successful puppeteer.
Yeah, spectacularly good.
Yeah, amazing. And so we had some amazing puppeteers, and they were literally manipulating Sandra. They had a little sort of metal block that represented her, and if they twisted it or tipped it up or down, she would twist or tip up or down. And we also had the ability to move that whole rig in X and Y, up and down the stage, and in height as well. And that would be computer controlled or puppeteered. I mean, all of this could be either a pre-programmed move or puppeteered live at the time. And so we would have to, on that system, we would have to coordinate either the two puppeteers controlling the different parts of it, or one puppeteer and the computer, with movements of the camera, with movements of the lights, with Sandra's action, so that even though there was no ISS there, it looked as though she was pushing off against the handle of the ISS and starting to move down the corridors through the dark bit, you know, so that all of those actions together worked in such a way that it looked as though something else was happening that you couldn't necessarily see on the set. So trying to assess as we were shooting that it was going to work once it was put in the set was actually one of the hardest bits, you know. Every take, it sort of Alfonso Chivo and I would be sort of sitting there watching it, and you know, we'd all have to go, yep, that works for my side of view, you know, that works for me, that works for me. You know, it was kind of a complicated thing to assess whether a take had worked, or, you know, as it happened, because you have to do it very quickly because there's not much time when you're shooting.
As I understand it, you studied physics at Oxford, right?
I did, yeah. Well, yes, I was supposed to be studying physics at Oxford. It did come in handy, yeah. I did. I also did a lot of art whilst I was at Oxford and before. I've always sort of been in between the two. I probably spent more time drawing than I did actually studying physics.
Ask you a physics question that I recently sort of got from somebody else who's making a floating in space film that I don't want to quote directly, but basically the problem is the shifting centre of balance or the center of mass as a person bends or turns. So the classic problem is normally that somebody's wire rigged from a hip based system and they would pivot on that hip based system. The trouble is if they sort of go to touch their toes, as it were, or they, you know, form a C shape with their body, the center of gravity moves forward from the hip, but of course you're still pivoting on the hip, which is why wire rigs can often look wrong no matter how hard you try to make them look right.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you had the additional problems, that things like if she's rotating, depending on how far out from her arms, the classic problem of an ice skater, or not problem, the ice skaters use very effectively, right? Their arms further out from their body or further in, changing their angle angular acceleration. So how did you deal with sort of this sort of stuff? Were we into this area where you're just having to go with the rig being much more digital, less wire rig? Because these are really hard problems to solve with wire rigs.
Yeah, now some of the bits we did, we would just use a traditional wire rig in some of the simpler motion. You know, when it's simple action and it's more about the dialogue or the facial expression, you know, moments like that, we would use a traditional wire rig because they're much easier, simpler to use and freer for Sandra to give her own natural performance. But as soon as we had to do any complicated motion, you know, if we needed to have more control, we needed to have more ability to create more complicated moves. We needed to not have to worry about things like the center of gravity changing and the strain that it puts on you when you're in those wire rigs. I mean, Sandra, even for what we had to do, she did an awful lot of work getting very fit to be able to work in these rigs. But you know, there's only so much you can control when you're in a traditional wire rig. So for the more complicated movements, we would use either this 12 wire rig or we would use the light box and she wouldn't really be moving at all. We would be moving everything around her and she would have to be sort of miming and acting as if she was moving through an environment that wasn't really there.
She did gymnastics kind of training for this, right? I mean, she really built up for the part.
Yeah, she did. And she, I think she had dancer training when she was young. And I think that was incredibly useful. I mean, she really was stunningly good. And I'm not just saying this because it's
spectacular performance.
Yeah. You know, yeah, it's a spectacular performance. And if you knew some of the complicated physical things she had to do whilst giving that spectacular performance, and she would hit them, you know, every time. It was amazing. We really got lucky having her in that role, you know, both from the performance and from her ability to, you know, to hit these marks and do complicated things at the same time. It was great. And yeah, she had to do a lot of work, you know, a lot of training to to get into a place to be able to do it.
Now, I want to take nothing away from her performance in the slightest, but after she... I mean, I've seen a photo of a rap party invitation, the date on which was the 28th of the 7th, 2011, and I saw the film very recently, so...
Yeah.
There's quite a bit of work that happened after you came off set.
There is, yeah. Now, we pretty much finished it at the end of last year. There was, you know, sound mixes and things going on, and there was one change was made to it as well, which was just turning the opening part of the opening shot upside down, which sounds like a simple change, but anything in this movie, you want to change anything, and because it's the continuous shots, you know, it's a big number, a major number. You know, as often as in any movie, you want to sort of speed up a little section, or, you know, that section is playing a bit slow after you've shot it, or this, that, and the other. You can normally do that with editing. You want to turn one bit of a shot upside down, you just flip that shot, whereas in a movie where it's continuous takes, nothing like that is that simple. So so turning upside down the first part of the first shot actually took a couple of months, I think, and that was going on in this year. But predominantly, yeah, we sort of finished at the, you know, the majority of the work at the end of last year. So it's not quite as long as it seems, but obviously an awful lot of work.
Yeah, I think you're being fairly modest. I think Steve, your CTO, put out a technical article in one of the trade presses, nothing to do with the story of the film, a little while ago, in which he at that time quoted 1.2 petabytes of data, which is to say, I looked that up actually just because I was curious how much a petabyte of data would get you, which is basically enough to store the entire DNA of the entire American population twice, or every MP3 that would play for 2,000 years. You guys had a lot of data on this. You did a lot of stuff.
Managing the data was hard, and...
That's bigger than Avatar.
Possibly, yeah, because it might well be. The managing the data was very hard. Managing the rendering was very hard. It was really scary as to whether we'd be able to render it all in time, because, I mean, another interesting statistic is, I think if we rendered it all on one, on a single core machine with a single processor in it, we would have had to have start rendering in something at the dawn of the Egyptian civilization to get it finished in time to release it. And you sort of ask people, you say, how long do you if we just render it on one machine, when do you think we'd have had to start? And some people say, 1950 or, something like that. And you have to say, no, actually, 5000 BC.
So let's assume for a second that you guys, your team worked with vast amounts of stuff. Walk me through what it was that you were doing. I mean, obviously, in terms of the, process, you mentioned already that you used physically based lighting and shading. What were you rendering in, and what was the sort of approaches that you were adopting?
So we used Arnold for the rendering, worked out well. I mean, it was a challenge. It's the first time we'd used it. It was a big change to make on a big show like that. It was quite scary to begin with. But the team that sort of developed all our in-house tools to work with Arnold instead of PR man was, did an amazing job. And actually, it went a lot smoother than it could have done. And I think, again, in terms of statistics, there was 71,000 lines of shader code was written for Arnold for the show. It was a lot of work.
Wouldn't the biggest problem have been holding it in memory? Because this is like such a – those space shots would have had so much data, wouldn't they, in a shot?
Yes, and I think that's something Arnold is very good at is the memory management and holding – being able to render scenes with an awful lot of geometry in whilst doing ray tracing on them. So, that helped. But, the render times were massive. And just working out ways of, apart from the simple technology, just making sure you were only rendering the right sort of thing at the right stage, i.e., what quality could suffer when you were doing test renderings but wouldn't change the effect on the whole movie. An awful lot of sort of careful management in those terms made a difference, and being able to, I think because of my role on the film as Alfonso really trusted me, and because I was the sort of main visual effects supervisor, but was also heavily involved in some of the detail of it, I was able to work out the correct balance of, you know, where effort should be put and where it shouldn't be put, so that as we were going through, doing first stage renders, we weren't wasting time making things look pretty, which didn't really matter, but that you sometimes have to do to show someone who doesn't understand the, you know, what you look, you're looking at and why you're looking at it, kind of thing. So trying to sort of balance things like that was very useful. Massive amount of rendering. But also, as with all visual effects shows, what really it comes down to is a talented crew. It's a huge amount of it comes down to craft, as more than technology, some of the, mm-hmm. the detail that the animators put into it, or the subtlety in the shaders, or the, or the time spent by the compositors putting breath on the visors, which is just a manual job, and listening to the breathing and looking at the head movement and, putting every single little breath on by hand. Goes into to make a huge difference.
What were you using for the, because there's obviously key destruction sequences where the debris starts the chain reaction. What were you doing to do that fracturing and debris fields?
So it was sort of largely, code written based, working in Maya, running in Maya. That was, pretty much everything was done, not absolutely everything, but, most of it was done in Maya with just in-house code that Framestore wrote to simulate that, the destruction. It was, because when we first test of it, just on, brightly coloured, simple wireframes, you could tell it was going to look good. The way it behaved felt very real. And I think that's
what I was going to ask you about, because the two things, expect out of debris is that they're going to decelerate and they're going to fall, and you had neither.
No, absolutely. And that it's quite tricky to sell certain parts of the movie where the way things actually work in space feels wrong. And all the stuff you normally put on when you're doing a simulation or to help you with a visual effects shot, even atmospherics, making stuff get sort of more wishy-washy as it goes into the distance, you can't use. And when there's an explosion in space, well, A, no one really knows what it looks like. There's no reference of that. And B...
Can't go on YouTube and look at space station destruction sequences.
No, exactly. And B... it doesn't look anything like it looks on Earth. So if you show it, it will look wrong to people. And we had to be very careful to try and, the film is all really massively about trying to be true to life and true to what really happens. And that was, something Alfonso was very keen on and I was very keen on. And
so did you get NASA consultants or former astronauts or...?
Yes, we spoke to astronauts about, in various aspects of it. And, NASA publish a huge amount of material as stills and video on their YouTube channel and stuff like that. So there's an awful lot of stuff we could look at, which was incredibly
useful. Have you read Buzz Aldrin's review of your film?
Oh, no, I haven't. I've heard a few astronauts talking about it, but I haven't heard his particular one.
Buzz published one today on behalf of another publication, and I thought it was interesting. He just said he thought there should have been more clouds down on Earth, but was very strong in his praise of the work that you guys did. There are so few people that would be in a position to actually comment on whether that looked realistic or not. We all think we know what we do, but very few of us actually do.
Yeah, absolutely. But yes, generally the comments, and that was a big worry actually for us, is would astronauts go, oh, well, that's nothing like this? Because, we consulted with these astronauts, we understood as much of it. You have to break away at times. There are certain things like the undocking procedure takes 15 minutes or something. I can't remember how long it is. Mm. Obviously, you can't have that happen when you're in an exciting moment, in the movie. So... there are certain things you have to break away from reality with, but as much as possible, we would try and make those in terms of the action, in terms of the look, in terms of the way things moved, in terms of, you know, everything. We would try and, first of all, make it absolutely true to life, and where we had to break away from real world, do it in a way that there was a logic to, that made sense.
What did, do you have any issues with the grading? Because one of the problems with LEDs, and that's, I mean, professional LEDs that are designed to be lights, is they have very weird spectral spikes and are non-uniform in their spectral frequency kind of distribution compared to, say, a Kinoflow or an ARRI. Did that present any problems in getting it kind of graded and matched in? What were you...
It did, yeah. It was because they do have, quite strange lighting. So, yes, it was tricky matching everything in because of that and because of the mixture of different lights. As I said, we did a lot of work to try and compensate for that up front in the lights, before the light was projected onto them. But it doesn't... It's just physically impossible because of the spectral spikes to solve all those problems. But... and it was tricky. I mean, we filmed on the ARRI Alexa, which was great because of its, it's got a pretty impressive dynamic range, and it enabled us to shoot at 800 ASA, and that helped a lot. I think having the nice clean images that you get out of that enabled us to have room to manipulate and to try and bring things in, but it was often quite tricky, yeah.
So the film, I saw it in stereo. It wasn't obviously filmed in stereo. How much of it was rendered in stereo and how much of it was a post-process conversion? Because the stereo was very good.
Yes, it was all rendered in stereo. And it's an interesting discussion to me. I don't count it as a post-converted stereo movie because, although the live action is post-converted, so much of it is actually CG, and that was rendered in stereo. All that material is like a native stereo project. In many of the shots, when all you're post-converting is a small face in the screen, it's not really.
I mean, compared to a debris field in space with, the complexity of that. Tell me, was there much of a creative discussion on that stereo? Because stereo really falls off after 20 yards or so. I mean, it's not like you get a lot of stereo in the true maths of space because everything is far away. Obviously inside the ship, of course, but outside.
Well, there was a lot of discussion, with Alfonso and Chris Bart, stereographer, and myself and Chivo. We had a lot of discussion about what degree do you push the stereo to enhance it? What degree, do you play up stereo for the fun of stereo, and to what degree do you keep it natural? And on the whole, we went for keeping it towards the natural end of things and towards sort of gentle, immersive stereo. There are moments where, we play with it and things coming towards the screen, so it's a balance. But
that wrench that she nearly loses, I could practically reach out and push it back to her.
Yes. And there's one bit of debris, which however many hundreds of times I've watched the movie now, every time it comes flying towards me, I flinch and jump because... Yeah, I should be expecting it by now.
It should be a real credit to you. The number of reviews I've read where people have said you should see this film in stereo, and I think it's a combination of how good the stereo is and the long takes producing this immersive effect that works well in a stereo. I mean, is that your opinion?
Yes, absolutely. I think there's a number of reasons why it works really well in stereo, we all knew from early on it was a made for stereo, really suited stereo. I think the long takes is the single biggest one to me. It really helps that you're not cutting, that you get a chance to enjoy the environment. That because of, as I was saying, that you feel like your physical presence moving around, and the stereo and that go hand in hand. They work, really well together because of the long takes. The generally shooting on wide lenses helps the stereo. The fact that in space you're doing all these weird rolling and moving, I think that helps the stereo. And the other thing I think that really helped was the fact that because it was so heavily previs and so heavily worked out beforehand and so carefully planned, we were able to plan the stereo for it. You're not having to make decisions on the shoot when you're just seeing a shot in isolation, or, you know, it gave us more ability to plot out exactly how the stereo should work and discuss it and try it out and, you know, decide which bits we should be pushing the stereo and which bits we should play it down. And so that helped as well. There was, frustratingly, the one thing that made it difficult for stereo is modern stereo projection techniques and the ghosting you get from the crosstalk between the two images, which is particularly bad when you have a high contrast thing.
Like a space station with sort of gold panels against black sky, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Or a spacesuit in bright sunlight against black sky. You couldn't really ask for anything worse. So we were always fighting that. And what I find particularly frustrating about that fact is probably in 5-10 years' time, projectors will be much better. And, you know, you would have been able to do it in a way where you weren't fighting that.
To a certain extent, I remember talking to the Apollo 13 guys when they were filming that. And one of the things they were trying to get in that film was a sense of glare because of, in space, just not having the atmosphere to soften. I wonder if it worked in your favour a bit, that if there was any ghosting. I wasn't aware of ghosting, but, you know, that sort of glariness in space is a bit of a defining harshness to the environment.
Yes, it did help. And one thing we did was we added quite a lot of lens effects, you know, sort of bleeding through a lens or flaring or, you know, chromatic aberration. I mean, beyond what you would normally have in normal filming, partly because it helps that feeling. It helps, you know, it helps sit everything together. And particularly because, you know, when you're filming in space, you're not able to necessarily, if you were really filming in space, you wouldn't necessarily be able to film with the best cameras and the, you know, swap lenses and, you know, do all that kind of thing. So it kind of suited the fact that, you know, it wasn't necessarily, or there was qualities to the images that sort of fitted in with that concept of, you know, what it would be like really filming in space. And I think that, you know, so that did mean there was a little bit of bleed off really bright lights. And the strength of the sun with no atmosphere on a white suit is, in, you know, the contrast between that and the shadow side. If you don't have the earth bounce filling in your shadow side, then the contrast is massive, much higher contrast than anything you get on earth because of the brightness of the sun and the blackness of space the other side. So there were often very high sort of contrast images and all of that helped with that.
You must have also been pleased just with your filmmaker hat on with how the audio finished up because...
Absolutely, yeah. They did a great job in the audio. Alfonso, again, you know, was going for this, trying to keep it real. And so, you know, the challenge of how do you not hear things you shouldn't hear when you're in space because there's a vacuum and, you know, he made that work with the music so that you kind of feel it, but you're not actually hearing something you shouldn't be hearing. And he played with the use of the silence of space, you know, using the silence very dramatically. And yeah, they did a great job. I just recently actually got to hear the Atmos mix. Up until then, I'd only ever seen it with the normal mix, but the Dolby Atmos mix.
It's great.
It is great, yeah. It really suits that sort of thing where you can have the sounds all around you.
I mean, there are a few films that I can think of in recent times where you need to see this in a good quality cinema. The concept you're going to somehow get the experience on even Blu-ray is you're kidding yourself.
Yes, I do think it's worth seeing on a big screen, and I do think it's worth seeing in stereo. You know, it is one that should be seen that way. You know, I think, you know, I wouldn't, you know, you have to be careful that if you're sitting at the front in an IMAX cinema, you can sort of lose some of the impact of it, I think. You know, if you can go too far. Yeah. But on the generally, yeah, big screen, is the way to go.
Well, thanks so much for taking time to talk to us. This is an amazing film. I just want to congratulate you and the entire team at Framestore. It's just remarkable effort and one that audiences are already responding to. But, oh, my God, as an industry, we just have been sitting here in awe of the work you've done. So thank you.
That's great. Thank you very much. Thanks.
We're going to really appreciate your time. So thanks so much.
Wow. Well, thanks, Tim, for taking time to chat with us. Mike, great interview as always. And, I mean, it's really fun to hear this after seeing the film because, as I said in the opening, I mean, I haven't been as blown away by a film in ages. I mean, I really can't. I'm kind of I'm at a loss of words for how I feel, how strongly I feel about this film and how great it was.
It is terrific to be sitting here and not have been like, we were so looking forward to this film and yeah, it's all right. But, you know, we were hoping for kind of a home run. This is really the home run. And yeah, look, terrific work by the team at Framestore.
Yeah, and really also from a perspective of stereoscopic and 3D, actually a great implementation of that as well. I've not always been a fan of stereo in films. I mean, Avatar I thought was really great. There are others that shall remain nameless that I didn't like as well. But I think this was really fantastic from the standpoint of the storytelling and the isolation and the feel of it. I think it was one place where the technique really shone through, frankly.
Absolutely.
Well, hey, guys, thanks so much for taking time to listen to this podcast. Again, we mentioned at the beginning that we just announced our new term over at FX PhD, so be sure to check that out. We hope to see you in the forums there. But as always, thanks for taking the time to listen. Drop us a line via the contact link if you have any comments, and be sure to check out the written article that goes along with this podcast. Thanks, guys.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.